From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
All eyes were on Buenos Aires Thursday as leaders from around the world assembled for this weekend's upcoming G20 summit. One question hanging over the meeting is whether or not the incident this past weekend off of Crimea between the Russian and Ukrainian navies would dampen the chances of a meeting between U.S. President Trump and Russia's President Vladimir Putin. Dan Ashby filed this report from Moscow for China's global television network, CGTN.
Trump initially came out saying that he might not go to the meeting with President Putin because he was so concerned about what had happened in Ukraine and he needed more information. But now we've had the Russian side actually coming out and naming a date, December the 1st, as when the meeting will happen, saying it is scheduled. Also listing the agenda, saying it will include North Korea, Syria, the Iran nuclear deal, the INF nuclear treaty. So I think the Russians are trying to calm things down, pin that date down and say it is going to happen. But there's no doubt that the Ukraine maritime clash has complicated things here because the US accuses Russia of aggression because its ships shot at and captured three Ukrainian vessels which were sailing near its territory. Ukraine, of course, denies that it's done anything wrong, but Russia says it was in the right, that it didn't break any laws. Dmitry Peskov, President Putin's spokesman, saying he disagreed with the US. But here's what President Trump had to say on it earlier.
We do not like what's happening either way. We don't like what's happening, and hopefully it'll get straightened out. I know Europe is not, they are not thrilled. They're working on it too. We're all working on it together.
So that tension on that particular issue is really going to make things a little more difficult, particularly when they have the big issue of the INF nuclear treaty to talk about. That is the landmark Soviet-US nuclear treaty limiting medium-range missiles, seen as a cornerstone of strategic stability. President Trump says he wants to drop out, but President Putin is going to try to go in and salvage it. At the moment, the odds don't seem good because President Trump seems set on his way, saying he's going to formalize his dropout. So President Putin says all the options are on the table, but a lot now hangs in the balance at this meeting. If it does happen, it certainly will be crunch talks. Dan Ashby, CGTN, Moscow.
With more information on the positions of the two sides, we have this report from CGTN's Wasnaya Bolden.
Both Russia and Ukraine have differing versions of the event, and each blames other for the face-off. First, let's look at the facts. On Sunday, two Ukrainian gunboats and a tug were sailing between Odessa in the Black Sea and Mariupol in the Azov Sea. The waterway that connects those two ports in the Kerch Strait between Crimea and Russia's mainland. Russia blocked them by placing a tanker under the newly built Kerch Bridge. The ships were then seized by its forces. Russia also scrambled two fighter jets and two helicopters to the area. Now here are the two versions of the event. The Ukrainian Navy claims that its boats were fired upon and seized as they tried to leave the area. It said 23 Ukrainians were on board and 6 crew members were injured. Russia admits that one of the patrol boats used force to seize the vessels, but claims that only 3 sailors were hurt. Kiev asserts that it notified Moscow in advance about the movement of the ships, but Moscow denies that it was given a warning. Accused Ukraine of violating international law in a pre-planned provocation.
The Russian claims about violation of the Russian border by the Ukrainian naval ships is an outright lie.
Under the 2003 treaty, vessels from both sides enjoy freedom of navigation in the area. But Russia says the treaty is very specific about following certain rules and regulations at the Crimean seaport of Kerch. Accuses Ukrainian ships of not following due procedure. But Ukrainian accuses Russia of blocking access to the Kerch Strait and describes the seizure as another act of armed aggression. Russia disputes this, saying it had no option but to fire at the vessels.
We consider such steps as a violation of Russia's sovereignty. These illegal acts meant that Russian customs vessels had to use force.
Tensions are growing between the two sides over access to the Black Sea and the Sea of Azov. Ukraine says Russia is trying to occupy the Azov Sea and damage Ukraine's economy by blocking access to two important ports. With Nayan said, Wang Xuan for CGTN.
This past weekend's incident in the Black Sea was the subject of discussion at Tuesday's State Department briefing with State Department spokesperson Heather Nauert.
Russia has rejected the idea of direct talks with Ukraine. What is the U.S. doing? Is the U.S. concerned that this might escalate out of control?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not going to comment on a hypothetical, but obviously what happened over the weekend was a serious escalation. It's a dangerous escalation on the part of Russians' continued aggressive behavior against Ukraine. The United States continues to support Ukraine's territorial integrity. The Secretary and the President both have a very strong relationship with the government in Ukraine, President Poroshenko in particular. Some of you may be aware the Secretary spoke with President Poroshenko yesterday, offering our support and expressing our concern over that dangerous aggressive act on the part of Russia. The Secretary is heading to NATO, as many of you know, in the coming days. I would imagine that that would be a big topic of conversation. NATO issued a very strongly worded statement earlier today. I would encourage you to take a look at that. Among the things that the U.S. government is doing, you saw Ambassador Haley's comments yesterday at the United Nations. The Secretary then had a call with President Poroshenko. We put out a statement ourselves, and we're continuing to have conversations not only with NATO, but with the OSCE and other multilateral organizations who share our concerns. Now, one of the things I think you'll be seeing in the days and weeks ahead are additional conversations that the U.S. government is having with our European allies. And one of the things that we would like to see take place is our European allies doing more to assist Ukraine. The United States government has taken a very strong position in their support, in support of Ukraine. We would like other countries to do more as well. That is something that's enshrined in our national security strategy, encouraging other countries to help one another around the world so that the United States isn't completely, I don't want to say shouldering the burden, but so the United States isn't handling these issues chiefly alone. Now, you may ask, what can European governments do? Many governments have imposed sanctions on Russia for its actions in Crimea, in Ukraine. Not all of those sanctions, as I have been told and our experts have explained to me, have been fully enforced. So that is one thing that we can look for European countries to do more when we talk about doing more. Also, something we've talked about a fair amount, but perhaps not enough, is Nord Stream 2. Nord Stream 2 is snaking through many of these countries, and I think that's a question European countries have to ask themselves. Is Nord Stream 2 something that they want to continue with because it helps the Russian government, and is that the kind of support that they want to provide the Russian government with continuing to back Nord Stream 2 at this time?
Ukraine didn't sneak into NATO over the past two weeks without anyone noticing, did they? I'm just curious as to why you kept mentioning.
It's a shared concern, and I just mentioned that NATO put out a very strong statement about its concerns, and so I think this is a issue that many countries around the world are concerned about.
Yes, I get that. But the point of my lead into the question is, are you envisioning, even though Ukraine is not a member of NATO, that there would be a step, something that NATO could do as an alliance?
I think it is important anytime that countries come together and express their serious concern. It was a Ukraine commission. They have something, NATO does, that's called the Ukraine Commission, and they held an emergency session yesterday, which they largely condemned Russia's actions in Ukraine.
But, I mean, are you saying that...
I can't speak for NATO, but I can tell you that a lot of these countries are concerned as allies.
I'm asking you if the U.S. government is pushing a NATO response to the incident over the weekend, even though Ukraine is not a member.
Matt, I don't have any information for you on that, okay?
Is this going to be a message to G20 pressuring more action
to bring pressure on Russia?
Yeah, I'm not going to get ahead of anything that the president may or may not discuss when he's at the G20. We look forward to being there in support of the president. And I just refer you back to the White House for anything on that, okay?
There are certainly some in Washington, D.C. who hope that the latest incident will provoke more tension between the U.S. and Russia. For more than 2 years, the Democratic Party and most of the U.S. corporate media have been waging a nonstop campaign to blame Russia for just about everything that goes on in the U.S. Ron Ridenour is a longtime activist and author now living in Denmark, whose latest book is entitled The Russian Peace Threat, Pentagon on Alert. He spoke with Black Agenda Radio's Glenn Ford this past weekend.
For more than 2 years, the Democratic Party and most of the U.S. corporate media have been waging a nonstop campaign to blame Russia for the myriad social and political conflicts that plague the United States. They call their conspiracy theory Russiagate. Ridenhour says there's nothing the U.S. military-industrial complex fears more than the prospect of world peace. He says the whole Russiagate affair is a misinformation campaign concocted by former CIA director John Brennan to rekindle the Cold War.
Peace is not an issue for the United States of America. Read somebody's comprehensive analysis of U.S. wars. I'm often writing about U.S. wars, and this person came up with 12 years since the beginning of the United States of America's liberation from England's colonialism. It's only 12 years the United States has not been at war. We're talking about maybe 650 wars or minor wars or major military interventions in the history of the United States. And, of course, it starts with the Native Americans, the Indians, the 300-year war against the Indians. There are 30 million Indians in North America, not including Mexico, when the Europeans came. And at 1900, there were 400,000 left. So peace is fake news. And the United States needs war. That's why it's the policeman of the world. The Danish media here, which I, of course, read and sometimes contribute to or have in the past, they don't like to take my stuff any longer. They openly, endorse and support the United States as the world's policeman, and they think that this protects them somehow.
But in the modern era, with Russiagate, this anti-Russian hysteria, Russia has been put in the center of U.S. crosshairs in ways that were not possible since the collapse of the Soviet Union.
Yeah, I guess you could say that. But, I mean, the Yeltsin, they couldn't make a war against Yeltsin. I mean, he was their alcoholic lackey. He, with Clinton and Wall Street, plundered Russia. The 10 years that he was the leader, there was a tremendous reaction against some political errors or mistakes or sins of the communist era, the Soviet Union era. That's a long discussion on what are sins and what are mistakes and why they were made. But there was a reaction, and the United States came in, as they always will, and took advantage and basically captured Yeltsin and the economy of that country. So they had no need to make war against Russia at that point. They emptied its gold reserves entirely. The length of life fell 5 years in just the 10-year period. Putin came along and he said, well, I'm no commie and I'm no longer in the KGB. There's no KGB. I want peace in the world. I basically just want sovereignty for my country, like many other leaders have wanted, whether we like them or not. People like Hussein and people like Gaddafi and Assad and many in Latin America. So that was his greatest sin right from the beginning. He even offered Bush, when 9/11 occurred, he offered him intelligence support to fly over his territory. He did a lot to encourage a friendship at the cost of lives in Afghanistan. It's not like Putin, in my eyes, is any tremendous saint. But the good thing with him was that he wanted to take his country back, and he began to do it. And the economy improved with capitalism. I mean, we're not talking about, a communist economy or anything like that. And that, of course, angered Wall Street and the Pentagon and the deep state, CIA. So that's why Russiagate exists today. There are, of course, many things happened since 2000 when he became the president. But it's logical that designed to dominate the world. I mean, that's what globalization means. It's another word for imperialism, but it's an imperialism that will totally dominate the entire world. I live in a little previously peaceful country. I mean, everybody that knows just a little about Denmark and Scandinavia has thought, well, it's tolerant, it's peaceful. They've made a vassal state of all of Europe. There's 500,000 troops in Europe, hundreds of military bases. In Europe, after the Second World War. You know, still here.
And the anti-Russian drumbeat got a lot louder under Barack Obama. His Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, called Putin Hitler, which is the kind of talk that you don't do in civil, polite society, much less in diplomacy.
No, it's ridiculous that anybody can compare Putin with Hitler. I mean, that's it. Who has he killed? I mean, we're talking about a man, Hitler, you know, who's responsible for the deaths of 50 to 80 million people, 6 million Jews, a million gypsies, etc. I mean, Putin hasn't even, it's not in Putin's agenda. There have been some local warfare within this the sphere of the Russian territory, what used to be Russian republics. You know, Russia has 12 bases outside of its own territory. 10 of them are in previous republics. Two or three of them only have radar stations. China, for example, has one military base outside of China in a little land in Africa near a base. It was a French colony. France has a military base, and U.S. has a military base.
In Djibouti.
Yes. And the general in charge of AFRICOM, you know, he wants to have troops, U.S. troops, and U.S. military bases in every African nation. I think there's 56. And Obama started to get military troops and bases in some of those lands. So, I mean, the United States has at least 800 military bases in the world outside of 4,000 military bases in the United States itself in every U.S. state. I mean, we're talking about gigantic mathematical numbers here where it's just absurd to begin to compare. The last statistics on the official U.S. budget for military is around $800 billion now. But it's about $1.2 trillion. But even if you take the official U.S. budget, that is 12 times what the Russian budget is. If you take the unofficial budget, it's 18 times. If you take all of the military budgets of all of the countries that are U.S. allies, the Commonwealth, the EU, the Europe, and NATO, we're talking about such a gigantic gap between them and the three or four countries that U.S. has on its current war list, that it's absurd to think that anybody in China or Russia would begin to be aggressive against the United States.
And in fact, the increase in the U.S. military budget of this year over last year is bigger than the entire total Russian military budget.
Right. You know, it's unfortunate. Of course, I'm no Trump fan, but actually Trump, you see the difference between Trump and most of the capitalists, or at least many of the capitalists, and those that support the Democratic Party, as well as many that support the Republican Party, is that he earned his profits by super exploiting the domestic working class, by and large. He made his money from buildings, and buildings have to exist in a particular place. And so most of these buildings were in the United States or are in the United States. So he was not thinking when he went into politics like a normal imperialist, you know, like going abroad and dominating everything. He was not at that point connected to the weapons industry. Well, just like every president that gets elected, the first day in office, the real leaders come into the Oval Office and they tell the new sitting president what the world is all about and what they demand. And so everybody in the military-industrial complex told Trump that he could not continue to be president if he didn't have some wars, you know. I mean, Bush had two wars. Obama ended up with seven. So, you know, Trump maybe didn't want to have too many wars, and he didn't want to have wars with Putin. And in fact, some companies that supported him, including Exxon, thought that they could make profit by not going to war with Russia, that they could be partners in the Arctic area with oil. You know, they could jointly make profits from trading with each other around oil. So, you know, but Trump had to break his initial thoughts and go with the military-industrial complex. Every president has. They killed Kennedy. Not that I'm a Kennedy fan. He was also an imperialist, but he was a rather clever and intelligent one. And he wanted to get out of the Vietnam War, and he wanted to change relations with Cuba because he came to the rational conclusion that a nuclear war would only be the way that you could perhaps win, but you wouldn't win when most of the Americans were also dead. So when he began to pull out, the CIA and the, you know, military-industrial complex murdered him. Well, this could have happened to Trump as well. Why not?
Vladimir Putin is an extremely popular politician in Russia, and yet people in the United States continually call him a dictator.
Well, long live dictators. I mean, Plato said, you know, what is the best political system? Plato's answer was a benevolent dictator. I lived and worked in Cuba for 8 years. I've written 6 books about it. I even got to know Fidel Castro a little bit. He read one of my books and signed his name, and now I'm patting myself on the back. But I'm telling you that Fidel Castro, in many eyes, is a dictator, was a dictator. Well, depending upon how you want to define dictator, let's say he was. I mean, the electoral process there would take another interview with me to explain. It's not all that simple. But there's no doubt about it that the masses of people wanted him where he was. And he, under his time in Cuba, you know, nobody died of starvation in Cuba. Everybody had, quote, free education and free health care. Of course, you pay for this with your wages. You pay for this by being a worker. The Cuban people had a much, much better life all those years than they ever did before the Socialist Revolution occurred. We can find throughout history people who have been strong men, who have been able to be successful in creating a decent society for the masses of people.
But Russia has multi-party elections, and Putin comes out way on top every time he runs.
Right. There were 7 other political parties that ran against his party, including the Communist Party, which comes in second all the time. They do not contend that he's a dictator. At any rate, Putin is the man that the Russian people need, and Putin is the man that the whole world needs. He is the epitome of a dove. And my book starts with another dove, you know, with Yuri Gagarin, first man to go around the world. And at that time, Khrushchev was the peace man, the man who saved the world, one of the Russians who saved the world from a nuclear annihilation the year after Yuri went around the world. Well, Khrushchev sent Yuri around the world with a peace dove on his uniform often, you know, saying we have to have peace. Bobby Kennedy was sent by Robert Kennedy to tell the Russian prime minister that if they did not take their bombs away from Cuba, that was on a Friday, by Monday, there was no way that the military-industrial complex could be stopped from bombing Cuba and Russia. Now, Russia has never done that. Russia has never threatened anybody with a nuclear war. So I don't care, Vexi, you know, how you want to define the leaders. There's no democratic leadership in the United States' history. Everybody that has been the president is there to support Wall Street and the military-industrial complex. You can't be president of the United States unless you have many millions of dollars behind you. You and I could never be president of the United States.
So why does the U.S. corporate media and the Democratic Party not let Russiagate go away, despite the fact that they have not come up with any proof of the predicate crime, collusion?
Well, I mean, you don't need any proof. I mean, Goebbels didn't need any proof. They agree with Goebbels. You know, you tell a lie, you tell a very big lie, and you tell it over and over again, and it becomes the truth. I mean, how many people in the world, despite all of the possibilities we have today with communication, with the IT world, how many people will devote the time that you and I devote to try to figure out what the hell is really going on? You know, most people are workers. They have families. You and I probably spend many, many hours every week just to try to find out what lie are they telling us and how are they doing it and what is really the truth. And who is the corporate media? I mean, the corporate media, of course, is owned by the corporations. You know, the same people that own the media also are involved in other enterprises, including weaponry. The weaponry is what you can't have peace and democracy as long as you have a weapon industry that must thrive on profits like every other capitalist concern. And you can't have profits in the weapon industry unless you have wars. You have to use all those bullets. What they're doing with Russiagate is not just against Russia. And not just threatening the world war and nuclear world war, they are dismantling the solidarity of people. The so-called progressives were once for peace, too, the white progressives. I mean, now you've got white progressives involved with supporting Russiagate. You've got this so-called socialist Bernie Sanders. I mean, he's a traitor to everything that he was supposed to have stood for. He and I were together, not that we knew each other, in Mississippi in 64. He was a good guy then. Why does he have to come out to be an imperialist? Well, you know, that's you obviously win elections that way. You obviously get money for your campaigns that way. Bernie Sanders only opposed one war. That was Iraq. And then after he said no to the Iraq war, he voted every time to send weapons and troops to Iraq. And these so-called people, these so-called democratic socialists, they're the same way.
Some people say that Russiagate has inaugurated a new McCarthyism. Well, I think you're old enough to remember at least some of the latter parts of the old McCarthyism.
Well, it certainly is. When I started being an activist, it was in 61. The Bay of Pigs got me involved. I'd been in the military. I saw it with my father. We listened to the radio in 56 when the Hungarian conflict occurred and Soviet troops came into Hungary. We know in hindsight, anyway, that the CIA was very much involved in making chaos and uproar in Hungary. Well, at that point, I was, you know, an American dreamer, and I quit high school and went into the military. I was sent to Japan, and on the military bases there, a radar base, it was totally segregated. White soldiers went around on that base in full uniform with a baseball cap on their head with KKK engraved in it. The barracks were segregated. When I came out of that, I began to wake up. What is it? What's going on here? What's going on? So when they invaded Cuba, I started to really protest. I remember Steve Allen. He was against the war. Every time he made a speech, he had to start by saying, "I am not a communist. I am not a communist." This was at the end of the McCarthy period, and still it was so important that if you wanted to criticize some important policies of the United States government, you had to be very clean. You had to not be a communist. Well, communism fundamentally, I mean, at least the power of communism in the state sense, is not happening right now. So you got to have a new enemy. Now, you don't start your talks or your discussions with, "I'm not a communist." You have to say, "I'm not a fan of Putin."
The nation's best-known political prisoner, Mumia Abu-Jamal, reports for Prison Radio on the twilight of U.S. empire.
The Trump era, when it finally passes from the stage of history, will not pass either easily nor willingly. It will have left the aura of anxiety, the pangs of paranoia, and the air of enmity. It will be bitter, nasty, and mean, and it will not end with death. It will leave a stench of anger, of hatred, and sourness that will long dwell in the national unconscious, as well as the memory of the world. Such will be the legacy of Trump. Such will be the unworthy inheritance of the American empire. For the better part of a century, America played the role of protector of the weak and benefactor of the world's oppressed. But that was when the world was a bipolar one. The fall of the Soviet Union made the world unipolar, the world's sole superpower. And with that reality emerged the U.S. without a peer and without a mask. We saw then his true, angry, contemptuous face, snarling at the Third World, hostile to its European ancestors, and dismissive of Latin America. That's because an empire needs no allies, nor any friends. It needs subjects. It needs satraps. Where empires are political, economic, and military machines of dominance and exploitation. Its power is its only justification for being. It matters little whether Trump completes the full 8 years of two terms or is there for the next 8 months. The die is cast. The empire has sat its utter contempt upon the world. The damage is done. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.